Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dharma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 25, 2017. My Dharma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Nagara Sutta. In this remarkable sutta, the Buddha describes his awakening in relation to dependent origination. If you find benefit from this recording, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. There is a related article to the Nagara Sutta on my website. Thank you. Peace. So the Nagara Sutta is a sutta where the Buddha describes the process he went through to awaken. And it really is remarkable in that way. I've been wanting to teach it, but haven't up until now for a few reasons. One is that after we went through, as a Sangha, went through the Truth of Happiness course, in the last 3 or 4 months since then, we've been spending a lot of time on dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates and how that relates to different aspects of the Buddhist teachings. Leading up to this, in a way. And then I also wanted to have, this is part of an important part of the new book that I just published called Becoming Buddha, that we'll be using on our retreat, and I wanted to wait until that timing was right and a few other things. That book is just about ready on Kindle right now, and it'll be the paperback version should be ready by the end of May, maybe a little bit earlier. And the book we'll be using the book on our retreat too. One of the things about the Nagara Sutta is the way that he develops, well, he doesn't develop it, but he makes a statement that he makes in many other ways, in many other suttas, and that statement is, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, and the Pali word is bodhisattva, means the same thing. And that's important. And I'm not going to read the whole introduction to the sutta, because it's rather long, and it does get into the differences between the Mahayana schools and the Bodhisattva path as opposed to the Buddha's Eightfold Path. It's pretty subtle to see, but there's some major contradictions between the two paths. And I get into my own experience taking that vow. The important thing about that is, and this is not a denigration of the ideal, a Bodhisattva vow is typically that I am going to gain awakening so that I can assist all others in awakening, and then there's a variation that I will delay my own awakening until all sentient beings are awakened. And the reason why that's contradictory is, for one thing, no matter how awakened I am, I can't awaken anybody else. And that's shown by what the Buddha did. The Buddha didn't awaken and then spontaneously every human being was now awakened. It doesn't work that way. It's individual ignorance that is the problem of individual suffering and confusion. So it's up to individuals to develop, and that's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. So that great altruistic goal of, I'm going to awaken so that I can save everyone else, just doesn't fit with the idea that dukkha occurs, and it's a contradiction of the Four Noble Truths. Now again, I'm not putting it down. When the Buddha is talking about himself as an unawakened bodhisattva, which he refers to in this sutta, he's referring to a very highly evolved state of human compassion. But it's still lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths. It's still lacking an understanding of the Eightfold Path. And you'll notice in this sutta, the Buddha refers to even himself developing the Eightfold Path as his path to awakening. And it really is remarkable. The other thing I need to point out, and I talk about this often, the metaphorical story of the Buddha's awakening, that at the end of this arduous struggle, after 6 years, he sat down under a peepal tree with the strong intention to sit in meditation until he awakens. And the malevolent god Mara is an important part of the metaphorical aspects of this story, who keeps coming after the Buddha, trying to knock him off his cushion. And of course, that's only Mara's metaphor for his mind states that he was going through, and recognizing the delusion in those mind states. And that's how metaphor is used throughout the Pali Canon. In this sutta, he describes what is going on while he's facing Mara, while he's going through these difficult mind states, and how he understands ultimately that it was ignorance of Four Noble Truths that was keeping him stuck, and he even uses a reference to being stuck in self-referential views. And it's really remarkable in that. So there's a lot leading up to this if you want to read it, but this is the Nagara Sutta. The Nagara Sutta, the Buddha describes his awakening. The Buddha was at Savatthi, Ajita's grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, before my awakening, when I was only an unawakened bodhisattva, I came to the realization of the difficulties of the world. Now, using the word world here as metaphor for ongoing dukkha, both in the world and in our own individual minds. The world is born, it ages, it dies, it falls away and returns. But there is no understanding of the ending of the stress and suffering of aging and death. When will the world understand the cessation of the stress and suffering from aging and death? Then I had the thought, what initiates aging and death? What is the requisite condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? Now remember, he's not talking about physical aging and death in the way that we can change that in some way, that we can somehow gain immortality or gain a state of being that is not subject to aging and death. The First Noble Truth says dukkha occurs, and it's in relation to that, and the stress that we feel from aging and death. Is that clear to everybody? So he's not talking about how to develop immortality. He's talking about how to end the problem of stress that's associated with aging and death. And that's an important point. And I'll make that point a little bit more clear later on, I hope. So let me reread that paragraph. Then I had the thought, what initiates aging and death? What is the requisite condition that aging and death are dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. And now, again, it's an important line. Appropriate mindfulness. He had to develop a certain measure of refined mindfulness before it was possible to gain this insight. Insight into what? From birth as the requisite condition comes aging and death. Now what is he talking about? Now he's not only talking about physical birth, but he's referring to it. But it is, getting back to dependent origination, the birth of ignorance. And that'll become clear as we go along here. From birth as the requisite condition come aging and death. Then I had the thought, what initiates birth? What is the requisite condition that birth is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From becoming as the requisite condition comes birth. From becoming. From becoming what? From becoming ignorant. Now look at it, listen to it in that terms, and I'm going to elaborate on that last sentence. From becoming ignorant, as the requisite condition comes the birth of suffering. So he's clearly, when taken in the context of dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths, he's clearly not just referring to being born as a human being. I'm going to read that one line again. From becoming ignorant as the requisite condition comes the birth of suffering, comes the birth of stress. Then I had the thought, what initiates name and form? And I'll explain that in just a minute. What is the requisite condition that name and form is dependent on for arising? This is in the article. Name and form, the Pali nama means rupa, so it's often nama rupa is how it's portrayed in the Pali canon. Name and form means self-identification through clinging to forms and self-referential views. And the Buddha elaborates on this a little bit later on. It's just remarkable. From Buddha's words, from my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. Now remember, this is not grand cosmic consciousness. It's consciousness or ongoing thinking that's rooted in ignorance.
John, can I ask a question?
Sure.
When he keeps referring to from my appropriate mindfulness, what does he mean by that?
He means the refined mindfulness that has been developed through engagement with the Eightfold Path. He now has a measure of right view. It's appropriate mindfulness. Excuse me. In other words, if it was still inappropriate mindfulness, it was still completely rooted in ignorance, he would not have the appropriate mindfulness. He would not have the level of mindfulness that it will allows him to see this process going on within him. Did I make that clear?
Yeah, I think what I'm struggling at, and I'll just have to like let it, you know, keep hearing it, because if he's, like, when we talk about mindfulness, it's mindfulness of recalling right view, right intention, you know, the awareness of the Four Noble Truths.
Yep.
And the Four Noble Truths is the good sensation, the path. So, but now he's, so it's almost like,
he doesn't have the cart. It sounds like he's got the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
He's describing. Now he's describing himself from an awakened point of view and describing that process. So from his appropriate mindfulness now, he's able to see these things.
Okay, I get it.
It's a great question because it can be confusing. Okay, from my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding from consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. These are my words. In the Paticca Samuppada of Abhanga Sutta, the Sutta on Dependent Origination, the Buddha shows that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that is the condition that the arising of mental fabrications are dependent on. You remember, dependent origination, ignorance leads to mental fabrications leads to consciousness. Remember, consciousness rooted in ignorance. Consciousness is dependent on mental fabrications. Consciousness then in this context is ordinary ongoing thinking arising from that ignorance. What arises from ignorance can only further ignorance unless something comes along to change that. The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, what initiates consciousness? What is the requisite condition that consciousness is dependent on for arising? From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From name and form, from self-referential views, rooted in ignorance, as the requisite condition comes consciousness. Now again, he's talking about an ongoing way of thinking that is conditioned by ignorance.
Can you say that one more time?
Yes, and the reason why I'm making that point is oftentimes when we hear that word consciousness, we take it almost compulsively, that we're referring to some grand cosmic way of thinking and viewing the world. That's not what he's talking about. So consciousness in this sense is simply ongoing thinking, ongoing conditioned thinking, or ongoing thinking that is rooted in that initial ignorance, not understanding the true nature of the world. And that's the only reason I'm trying to make that clear, using that word consciousness.
It's a clinging consciousness.
It's a clinging conditioned consciousness.
This order of things that he's describing here does not follow the order.
It doesn't. And you'll see why.
Okay.
I hope you'll see why. So he's not trying to he's not teaching dependent origination now. He's simply teaching the process that he went through to awaken. Now, dependent origination, the way it's taught in the Paticca Samuppada of Abhanga Sutta, is teaching the entire process of developing suffering from ignorance, and he's going methodically through each of those steps, and he does that here later on in the sutta.
Oh, he does.
Yeah. And since you bring that up, there's other descriptions of dependent origination in other suttas, where in one there's only 9 links, and in the Paticca Samuppada Sutta there's 12 links of dependent origination, which is usually how it's portrayed. But in some suttas there's only 9. And you'll see when he gets to this name and form consciousness part that it really could be, in the right view, one cause and condition. That might be more confusing than anything else. From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From name and form as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Now remember, just before, he was saying that it was consciousness that brings name and form. It brings self-referential views. Now he's saying that it's self-identity that is driving consciousness. But what he's describing is a distraction of dukkha, how we get caught up in self-referential views. And I make a reference in just a little while to that, I can't think of his name now. I think, therefore I am. No,
Descartes.
Yes, and the reason why Descartes came up with that is he was looking for an absolute statement that could not get refuted. And after a lot of pondering, he came to that idea, wow, the what can't be refuted is I am because I think I am. And that contradicts what the Buddha is talking about. And the thing about it, that is a completely self-referential view. It's a thicket of views that arise from that. And the Buddha went through exactly the same thing. 2400, I think Descartes was.
Descartes was
17
something.
Yeah, so, well, quite a bit before that. So what the Buddha is beginning to describe here is the feedback loop caused by self-referential views and then relying on those views, rooted in ignorance, to describe our reality. Does everybody see the problem there? And we get stuck in that. It's like, and I think I say it here a little bit later, it's like now the world has become the mirror for these views rooted in ignorance. And it keeps bouncing back to us, and we keep using our experience in the outer world to validate the confusion that we have inside. It's exactly like what Descartes said. I think, therefore I am. Self-referential views. It's what the Buddha talked about as anatta. I know I'm covering, and I hope I don't cover too much in this. Remember, this is all taught in the context of Four Noble Truths. It's taught in the context of the three marks of existence, of impermanence, not self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. And let me keep going, because I think some of this will become even more clear. The next thing I was going to say here refers to Descartes, and I don't need to say that again. Lacking understanding, the resulting reality described ignores or continues ignorance of any thought, word, or idea that arises that would challenge these views, now conditioned by ongoing ignorance. Once established, a framework for recognizing this feedback loop is now necessary in order to recognize and abandon these wrong views. That's exactly the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. To overcome the common human problem of conditioned thinking, of being stuck in this feedback loop. When the Dhamma is, this is my words, I'll continue with my words, when the Dhamma is developed, it is clearly understood that what constitutes a self is always in a constant state of becoming. Consciousness rooted in ignorance can only continue this feedback loop, furthering ignorance. The world becomes the mirror feeding back wrong views. As the Buddhist path is developed, consciousness is framed by the Eightfold Path, and becoming awakened, becoming Buddha, which is, by the way, that's the name of the new book, Becoming Buddha.
Who thought of that?
Who? I think I did. I think my dog did, but it's a good title, isn't it? The Buddha continues, then I had the thought, this consciousness, this is such an amazing part of the Buddha's teachings, then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form, and goes no further. He's talking specifically about being stuck in self-referential views. Now think of the Buddha himself. I have this ignorant thinking that keeps turning me back on myself. How do you get out of that? This is ultimately what he describes as the confining space of his own mind, the confining space of his own thinking. How do you get out of that? An Eightfold Path. I think I lost the page. Let me go back a little bit. I know I keep repeating myself, but it's important. No, I won't. When the Dhamma is developed, it is clearly understood that what constitutes a self is always in a constant state of becoming. Consciousness rooted in ignorance can only continue this feedback loop, furthering ignorance. The world becomes the mirror feeding back wrong views. I just want to say that again, and then repeat what the Buddha said. Then I had the thought, this consciousness turns back at name and form, at self-referential views, and goes no further. It is to this extent that there is birth, aging, death, falling away, and returning. To this extent, to being stuck in that way of thinking, that you're feeding back your own ignorant views to yourself, that's what gives birth to all the rest of the suffering. And so the entire Buddha Dhamma, what he spent 45 years of his life teaching, is to recognize that process and interrupt it. This is where ignorance is established. From self-referential views, meaning name and form, is the requisite condition that brings consciousness and from self-referential views, consciousness is the requisite condition that brings name and form. Is everybody clear now on that feedback loop that we get stuck in? Yes?
That's making me want to not do anything on social media.
That's a good place to start. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base, or five physical senses and consciousness rooted in ignorance, is dependent on the condition of name and form. Now again, the Buddha is not saying simply because of self-referential views we have developed physical senses. In the context of dependent origination of the Four Noble Truths, the sixth sense base is the continuing of that feedback loop. It's how we perceive now this world of dukkha that's rooted in that initial ignorance, that feedback loop. Now that anything that comes through contact, through our physical senses, can only increase that ignorance. It only continues to validate those experiences.
But not if it's from an awakening consciousness.
Yes, he's describing that process. When he was, again, remember that. That he's describing the process of awakening.
Okay, we'll get to all that.
My words. The Buddha is... I have to say that again. I'm sorry I keep interrupting and having to repeat it, but I want to make the point on where it needs to be made. Then I had the thought, the sixth sense base is dependent on the condition of name and form, dependent on self-referential views, and this is the origination of the entire mass of suffering. The Buddha is stating that it is being stuck in the feedback loop of self-referential views, seeing all objects, events, views, and ideas from the perspective of me, and how objects, events, views, and ideas may affect me. And of course, that's the ongoing distraction of dukkha. For example, not getting what is wanted, receiving what is not wanted, ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences all arise from the initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha continues, vision arose. He's talking about his awakening now. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, and in that case, discernment is right view. Knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me, with regard to things never known before. And that last line is important for a lot of reasons. One is, in some of the later developed schools, it's told, and even in this sutta, it's said that this is an ancient path that the Buddha discovered. In other words, a path has been around forever. That phrase there, with regards to things never heard before, is something the Buddha said repeatedly, and it's important to remember. Then I had the thought, what is the condition that the cessation of the stress of aging and death is dependent on? From my appropriate mindfulness came a breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of birth, now it's always written that way, but remember, I touch on this a little bit later. The appropriate translation would be from the cessation of the birth of ignorance, because that's what that keeps it in context of dependent origination. I won't get into why, but from the cessation of the birth of ignorance as a requisite condition comes the cessation of the stress of aging and death. Speaks directly to cessation of the process. From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of consciousness, meaning thinking rooted in ignorance, as a requisite condition, comes the cessation of name and form, comes the cessation of self-referential views. Very direct and very methodical about how to undo this chain of dependencies, isn't it? That's what he's describing, exactly how he did this, how he awakened. From my appropriate mindfulness came another breakthrough of understanding. From the cessation of name and form, as the requisite condition, comes the cessation of consciousness. So he's describing directly how to break, how to interrupt that feedback loop that we all get stuck in. Then he makes the following statement. I have obtained the following path to awakening, and it's not in there, but thusly. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. Directly addressing the feedback loop. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. In other words, now my senses are no longer providing the feedback loop that keeps me stuck. What does that mean? It means that now my senses can be trusted to provide an ongoing life of lasting peace and happiness. I can enjoy my life without that feedback loop, without self-referential views. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Now remember, feeling in this sense is not, he's not teaching annihilation, he's not teaching that we become robots. Feeling in this sense is referring to any disturbance in the mind that's rooted in ignorance. The cessation of an agitated mind is what he's talking about. Again, it's easy to take this stuff out of context, and it often is. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving.
An agitated mind, not meaning like an agitated mind, but a mind that is
a distracted mind. Yeah. Any
craving,
in that sense,
pleasure or aversion or craving.
Yep.
For
what he just said.
What's happening?
Yeah, thank you. And feeling in this sense, and when Buddha's talking about feeling as the second factor of the four foundations of mindfulness, he's not just talking about a physical feeling. He's talking about any disturbance in the mind that's rooted in ignorance, any distraction in the mind. That's what a feeling is in this context. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. Ultimately, craving is for continued establishment of an ego-bound self. Craving for the continuing establishment of self-referential views. And it's very clear why we do that now, because we're stuck in that feedback loop. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. So once we've established what we want and what we don't want, we create an identity over that, and now we're clinging to that, to the establishment of the identity rooted in craving. And remember, everything, or this whole process, is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. Again, the question often comes up, because it's so vague, becoming what? From the cessation of, I'll read it another way. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming ignorant. From the cessation of becoming ignorant comes the cessation of giving birth to ignorant suffering. To state it as it comes out of the sutta, from the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. But of course, the Buddha is talking about ending ignorance through wisdom. From the cessation of giving birth to ignorant moments, I'm adding that part about ignorance. From the cessation of birth, then the stress of aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. From the cessation of ignorance. From ignorance through 12 observable causative links comes all manner of suffering. And he's describing exactly how he went through this process and how each and every one of us can go through the process. The Buddha continues. This is the cessation of the entire mass of stress. And he goes back to that statement he made earlier. Vision arose, understanding arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me. Now what illuminating insight is he talking about? Insight into dependent origination. That's something else that's lost in the modern insight movement. Illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never known before. My words, the confusion that often arises in modern Buddhism is taking these teachings out of the context of dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths. Each of these statements, when seen in the proper context, shows that ignorance of Four Noble Truths originates the process of becoming stuck in a feedback loop of wrong views, a thicket of views. When wisdom and understanding is developed through the Eightfold Path, then giving birth to further views rooted in ignorance ceases, and the conditions that the stress of aging and death, of sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are dependent on all cease. The Buddha continues. In this way, let me just read it. In this way, I saw a timeless path to be traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. That means anyone that wants to awaken. And what is this timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones? Just this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. He continues, this is the ancient timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. I followed this path. In other words, what he's saying there is this path has always been here, but someone had to discover it. Someone had to find it. Someone had to find the yellow brick road. This is the ancient timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened one. I followed this path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the origination of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the cessation of the stress of aging and death, direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of the stress of aging and death. I followed this path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of birth, becoming, clinging, craving, contact, the six sense base, name and form, consciousness. He's referring to dependent origination there. Direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness, thinking rooted in ignorance. Direct knowledge of the cessation of thinking rooted in ignorance. Direct knowledge of the path leading to the cessation of thinking rooted in ignorance. I followed that path. This is why this is so remarkable. The Buddha is saying directly to those gathered and to us for all time, I followed the Eightfold Path to Awakening, and which is why that's the only path he ever taught. I followed the path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications. Direct knowledge of fabrications and the dependent origination, ignorance, is the requisite condition for fabrications. Following that, I came to direct knowledge of fabrications, direct knowledge of the origination of fabrications, direct knowledge of the cessation of fabrications. He's had the experience of it, the third noble truth, that having the experience of the cessation of suffering. Direct knowledge of the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of fabrications. Knowing this directly, I have revealed it to monks, nuns, male and female lay followers, so that this undefiled life has become powerful. Now, undefiled is usually translated as holy. And the only reason I change it, to me, holy means a holistic, well-integrated life, but just to take any religious connotation out of what the Buddha's teaching, because that wasn't his intent. This undefiled life has become powerful, rich, detailed, well-populated, widespread, and proclaimed among many beings.
That's the end of this. Well-populated?
Well, he's teaching this after the establishment of the Sangha, well after he's... Okay. In fact, again, I wish there was a way of dating this. It's only really by speculation and conjecture that I can put a date on it, because nobody can. But this seems like something that is pretty well along into his teaching career. Because he's referring to a lot of people, but also that there really was no context until people have began developing the path. They wouldn't know what he's referring to. If you heard this out of context, if you never came to any of my classes or knew anything about the Buddha's teaching, and I said this, it's complete nonsense. But in the context that it's taught, it makes perfect sense. So just a little bit longer. These are my words. That's the end of the sutta. The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path to overcome the common human problem of self-referential views. Keeping one stuck in the feedback loop of conditioned thinking, conditioned by ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And I just want to make a point here. I'm talking about the contextual edit that I made to that last line about the timeless past. In this way, I saw a timeless path to be traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones. And what is this timeless path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones is often translated this way. In the same way, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled by all the self-rightly awakened ones of former times. And what is that ancient path? That ancient path traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times, the Eightfold Path. Now, I made those corrections so that this presentation does not contradict with the Buddha's statement here and in many other suttas, that this is the cessation of the entire mass of stress, vision arose, understanding arose. Discernment arose, knowledge arose, illuminating insight arose within me with regards to things never known before. And that is just an important point. The Buddha said that line continually, in regards to things never known before. So leaving out a few key words and taking things out of context makes what is a very simple and direct teaching almost impossible to develop. But in the right context, in the way the Buddha presented this context, and in the context of dependent origination in the Four Noble Truths, he's describing a very simple and direct path to awakening. And he's telling us, again, this goes back to taking refuge in the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. He's saying, this is the same path that I took. This is my experience. This is how it's done. recognize that we're caught in that feedback loop and develop the Eightfold Path. Now, he talks about appropriate mindfulness, and Maura, it was really great that she brought that up. It is the refined mindfulness that's developed through concentration, Samatha Vipassana meditation, developing concentration, that allows us to hold in mind, the refined mindfulness, hold in mind the Eightfold Path as our framework for awakening. And why should we do it? Well, because an awakened man said, this is how I did it, so we might as well give it a shot. That's the end of the talk today. Before we go around the room, is there any questions about this really incredible sutta?
I was always under the impression that the Buddha developed the Eightfold Path as a teaching tool.
Exactly. Yeah.
But here he's saying that he actually, his awakening was a result of he himself.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. You're saying he followed those paths and
awakened.
I can't
quite make out from the sutta which way I should look at this.
Well, exactly the way you just said it. It is a teaching tool. Mm-hmm. And it's an effective tool that we can take true refuge. True refuge means that we have a feeling of safety and comfort. We can take true refuge in it because we know it's the Buddha's path that he is now teaching us. Now, upon his awakening, and I think I know where my teaching has confused you. Upon his awakening, the Buddha sat for another couple weeks pondering, is there a way that I can teach this to other people? And looking back on his own awakening, he realized that's exactly how he should teach it. In fact, he realized that it was the only way that he could teach something to overcome the common human problem of conditioned thinking. He was reflecting on that feedback loop that kept him stuck in ignorance. Now, going back even when he was a unawakened bodhisattva, it's interesting that it refers to that in this sutta. Because he was still stuck in it. But now he realized it, and so now he knows what he can teach and how to overcome that common human problem.
Yeah. What I don't see here is how he described how the various parts of the Eightfold Path actually helped him in his awakening.
The individual components.
Yeah, the individual components. Maybe I shouldn't be looking for that.
Well, I think it's a fair question. But remember, teaching this in the context of the Four Noble Truths, he developed the Eightfold, he broke down the components of the Eightfold Path in a way that was useful for someone developing it as a framework for the path. Just to use a different metaphor, I can tell you how to hang a door in a general way. And I could explain to you what I did as I hung the door, or I can write out a detailed description of that. What's more useful to you? Listening to me tell you how I did it, or to give you a detailed description of the process? So he does both in the sutta. He gives the details of what he went through, what occurred within his own mind. And then he coalesced that into a very clear and direct path to be mindful of. And I think he makes that point incredibly clear here, and it's so important. I mean, it's one of the things that is so remarkable to me. Now, if you read the article about, again, I gave a lengthy, there's a lot of the introduction is based on this, the Bodhisattva and describing the differences between the paths, and I relate my own experience to that. And I know I've talked about this a few times here, but I took the Bodhisattva vow and I'm still deeply involved in a Tibetan tradition. But it always left me uneasy because it just didn't make sense. And I thought, okay, I mean, I just have to understand this. And it wasn't until I realized that that wasn't a path that the Buddha taught, and I actually formally disavowed it through this little ceremony. And then came across this sutta. And directly after, but eventually I came across the Nagara Sutta, and that is when I realized the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path as a path to awakening, not these other things that I was involved in. And it really did literally change the direction of my practice. I still had to develop an understanding, but it pointed me for the first time in the right direction. towards the polycan and towards the four noble truths and dependent origination.
It's clear that this is a later sutta because he goes in detail into the four noble truths and dependent origination.
Yeah.
And we know that he didn't teach dependent origination right away.
No, he didn't, and it's hard. I mean, it could have been 6 months or a year after he awakened, but I think it's probably a little bit later on than that. And again, I'm just speculating, which is probably silly to do. It doesn't really matter. The point is that the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, and in his very first teaching, he taught the Four Noble Truths to explain what happens from that process, from that ongoing process. And when he taught that teaching, Kandana, you hear me say it often, Kandana said, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. He's referring to the conditioning that arose from ignorance. And once you gain an understanding of that process, you can bring it to interruption. Touching back on that bodhisattva and all the words there, the point of that is that establishing the bodhisattva path as opposed to the Eightfold Path will only reinforce that ignorance. Again, the Buddha refers to it here, when I was unawakened bodhisattva. We can't substitute something else. So, again, that's the end of... Do you have a question, Judy?
Yeah, I get stuck at every time there's a discussion like this where, okay, you're talking about the feedback loop and... So, what is not self-referential? What is not in terms of thoughts and opinions and feelings? I mean... I have a hard time thinking about. I can easily place some kinds of things into that category, but what's not?
another way of saying that, when the Buddha used the word anatta, he used it to mean the views that you're holding of yourself, the self-referential views that you're holding yourself, in reality don't constitute a self. Let go of the views, because they're wrong views. Now, they're wrong views rooted in ignorance. Upon developing awakening, it doesn't mean that there's no... This is another misunderstanding. It doesn't mean that you just vanish.
Mm-hmm.
It simply means that you are now a self that is free of ignorance. You're free of all wrong views. And because of that, your mind is now at peace. And you're continually living in reality. It doesn't, to some people, especially people that would like Buddhism to be some mystical esoteric teaching that allows us to escape the human life and travel around the cosmos or something like that, that might seem pretty disappointing. But when you realize what the Buddha is teaching is how to develop the opposite of the word dukkha in Pali is a word sukha. Dukkha is D-U-K-K-H-A. Sukha is S-U-K-K-H-A. Dukkha means ongoing suffering. Sukha means human flourishing. It means thriving. So we're not losing anything of value. And we don't lose a self, but we let go of all self-referential views. And we live a life from that standpoint. We live a human life of deep meaning and purpose, of being mindful of what's occurring without the need for it to be any different. Another way of saying that, all craving and clinging comes to cessation. When the Buddha described an awakened human being, he described their mind as calm and their state of being as unbound and released from clinging. Take care, Lorna.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Did you want to say anything before you go? I can...
No, it would be out of contact if we don't go around, No,
I'll
save it for another week.
No, I mean, if you want to talk now, you can before you go.
No.
Okay.
Keep it another way. I'll keep it.
All right. Get home safe. Just wanted to make sure. Okay, so let's go. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it did. And I like that feedback loop is a really good picture.
Yeah, it's easily seen, isn't it?
Yeah, and you can start seeing how you do that all the time without even realizing it.
Yeah. It really is. It's common, but... It took an awakened human being to recognize that he was stuck in it and to teach a way out of it.
And that's exactly, everyone does it. I do it, people do it. But what I think has made my son so stuck is that he lives that, I think, 24/7.
Yeah, well, most, that's a common human problem. It's not just your son.
Yeah.
I'm glad you made it tonight. Helen, how are you? Good to see you.
John, thank you. I guess it just boils down to avoid self-referential views, and you will cease a life of dukkha and perhaps reach a life of sukha.
That's it. You got it.
You can go home now.
Well, it honestly, it's not all that much more than that, you know. I mean, but we need a path to go from dukkha to sukha. Mm-hmm. Judy, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. I don't really have anything tonight.
I'm glad you
enjoyed
this.
Yeah,
it is remarkable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Andrew, good to see you.
I don't have anything to add, but I just want to ask a question.
Sure.
A human life, a young-born child, as it exits the womb, is it simply exposure and recognizing that it is hungry or cold begin the process of self-referential views and eventually delusional thinking? Because kids are so innocent so early on. At one point, is this or is it a given? Every human being from the beginning of conception carries this?
What a great question. Someone was remarking a couple weeks ago that how can we stop our babies from doing this and developing this way? And the only possible chance I think you have is to be awakened parents, and most of us aren't yet. But
sorry,
what you can do is to create the most loving and awakened environment for that child to grow up in. But even that's not likely enough, because the Buddha points out here that individual will at some point have to develop the Dhamma himself or herself. Now, when the first account of the Buddha teaching his 7-year-old son, Rahula, is when he was 7 years old. And so at a very early age, even though Rahula grew up in the palace too, sans the Buddha had left right after that Rahula was born, meaning it's never that early to start creating the environment. But a child born into the world is subject to the same conditions that lead to the development of ignorance of the Four. Again, remember, it's not we're just ignorant because we're born. We develop ignorance of Four Noble Truths along the way through conditioned thinking. So it's a great question. It also relates to developing understanding of the three marks of existence: impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and resulting dukkha. Because any child born in the world is in that environment, and the stress and misunderstanding that arises from that creates ongoing suffering. But it's not, again, it's not a lifelong sentence that we're stuck in dukkha. If we're fortunate enough to come across a path to get out of it. Again, that's what the Buddha taught. And it's the reason why I said the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all others is to develop the path. So at least that as individuals, we can be an example to children being born. Now you have to remember that the Buddha never saw himself, and I touch on this in the article too, the Buddha never saw, this is the difference between a bodhisattva vow and the Eightfold Path. The Buddha never saw himself as a savior because he knew it was unrealistic. It didn't relate to reality. And he never tried to teach a salvific religion. He simply taught a path that anybody that was interested could take up and develop awakening for themselves. So a newborn is not capable. They don't have the mental capability yet of developing the Eightfold Path. But in the right environment, very quickly, Rahul is a good example. At 7 years old, he was given his first, well, maybe it's not his first teaching, it's the first recorded teaching. And very quickly, I think Rahul was about 13 or 14 when he received preliminary ordination, and the only thing that was holding him back at that time was his age. And when he became, I don't remember the exact numbers, maybe let's say around 20 years old, he was now a full member of the Sangha. And Rahula had an important part for the rest of his life in helping other people awaken. So the fact that a human birth is often quite dukkha-like, there's probably, you know, there's a lot of suffering involved in it, the potential there is for awakening for every human being. We're not stuck in it.
But the tendency for the human mind as it develops from birth on, is to become this self-referential mind.
Yeah, well, the Buddha refers to that here. That's the definition of the world. The world is like that.
Yeah,
and so unless you have a way of seeing it clearly, and the Buddha never referred to himself as a Buddha. He referred to himself as the Tathagata, which means the one who has gone forth and left the world behind. So obviously he didn't leave the planet, but he left clinging to the world behind. And that's what he's pointing out. And that's what any human being has the potential to do that.
You know, but it's funny, when he said the thing about the baby, at first I laughed. But then I thought about all the stress that happens to a child, even in a loving environment.
Yeah.
And how that can shape their perception of the world around them even before they can articulate it.
Yep, the First Noble Truth states, dukkha occurs.
Yeah.
It is impersonal to everyone. The three marks of existence are called that, impermanence, not self-characteristic, and dukkha, because every human being has those marks. Meaning, it's something that we have as a consequence of having a human life. So you can say that when the Buddha awakened, and this is something I don't often talk about, when the Buddha awakened, it's not there, he had his hand like this, and he put his right hand on the ground next to him. And that signifies that he has overcome the world. And what he said was, I have overcome the world. For me, there will be no future births. And he meant that in two ways. There's no possibility of him now as an awakened human being of giving birth to another ignorant moment. And he's no longer stuck to giving birth to another human birth that's subject to suffering. If you have a human life, dukkha occurs. We got to find a way to get out of it. And again, one of the reasons why I don't talk about this often is we get stuck in this thing, these views about reincarnation and rebirth. Maybe I shouldn't get into it right now. But the bottom line is that if we develop the Eightfold Path, which any human being can do, we will never give birth to another ignorant moment or another ignorant rebirth that's subject to ongoing suffering, as the Buddha describes suffering. And let's stay out of the somewhat esoteric idea of what happens between life. But it's just this, it's, oh, yeah. I almost went somewhere. it's such a great question. Any other questions or comments?
Well, I think I understand it. It's simply the stress of being alive, simply to get air and water and food, regardless of the environmental influences that others may have around it. I mean, that is stressful in itself. Maybe we're dropped into the jungle to be raised by a family of monkeys, the stress level would be just as high or higher.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's all types of different scenarios where life is just much more difficult for some than it is for others. It's not meant to be fair.
Yeah.
And I should point out that has nothing to do with karma, or very little to do with karma. Just if you have an extremely difficult life, it doesn't mean that you have bad karma. It's just worldly causes and conditions. It's a really insightful question, too, to go there and ask that way. Because it doesn't seem fair, does it? Life isn't fair.
It's just a gift.
That's the profoundness of the First Noble Truth. Dukkha occurs. Mm-hmm. We can't escape it. But getting caught up in the idea that somehow we can and we should, that's what drives our life now. That's true craving.
It's funny because some people I know who have gone through really terrible things, and I've gone through some pretty crappy stuff too, they say, you know, without it, I wouldn't have come to a certain understanding about my own strength or about life and what's important. And so, even though it was horrible, they don't...
Hold on, Maura. You want...
Take it back, yeah.
I just want to hear if you had anything to say about the sutta before you go.
Oh, I'm sorry I have to leave. Just details to attend.
Okay. Right.
Do I have anything to say about the sutta?
Or anything else?
I don't think I have anything to say. All I could say is understanding, like Lauren and I were just talking outside,
every time I hear something like this, it's just another little kernel that is reinforcing the idea of just seeing, it further motivates me to be applying right effort and all that, to really see that, you know, feedback loop and let go of it. I think I had my own physical practice the past couple of weeks of really looking at attachments and self-referential views and kind of a lived experience of working with all that.
Well, thank you for saying that, and that's exactly what this suit is about, and all of it, to get us going in the right direction, another little kernel of truth. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
Give me a call later if you're up for it.
I will. Bye.
So again, just to touch back on that of birth and the suffering that is inherent in that.
Sorry.
No, I know you got to go. So.
Yeah, but the clarification of the birth of ignorance, I thought was something. So maybe we could kind of. I can't encourage anything in here, but that piece of I like some of the. I like the birth of ignorance as a kind of holding on to a little bit more for some juice, and I would love to revisit. Because I tuned out for a second on when you were talking about the ancient path. And I really wanted to, because that's something that, yes, I'm familiar with. I rediscovered the ancient path. And I have a lot of questions around that, but not for tonight. Because I checked out for a second. I was counting guests.
Well, we'll talk about it.
Well, you and I will talk about it.
Yeah. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter if it was an ancient path that traveled by many before. But if you want to look at it, the Buddha rediscovered it, and he said, this is the path that I use.
It seemed to me, but I really did lose it for just about 10 seconds, and I missed some point that you were making there. What I heard when I rejoined the present teaching was that it seemed to me that perhaps, and I could be totally wrong about this, but rediscovering the ancient path was almost like the links of dependent origination. Yeah. So could that be it? That was there. That is ancient. That is what is occurring. And discovering that rather than, you know, the walking this path, this eightfold path, but discovering how that all puts together and how we unpack it.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's the realistic way of looking at it. The reason why I'm making the definition there is that because of the misapplication of that, it's often presented that there's innumerable Buddhas going back into the past and into the future, and all this, the future Buddha is going to be reborn. And so what it does is it both elevates the human Buddha and diminishes him at the same time. Mm-hmm. It sets him up as one god among many, which is what the Mahasanghikas wanted to do. It's the beginning of the Mahayana path. And it also says, nothing really original about this guy. You know, it's an ancient path. So what? We don't have to take it so seriously. The correct way of looking at it in the context, and again, it has to be seen in context or it doesn't make any sense, is that a human being used this path, he awakened to it, this sutta says, this is what I did, and this is what I teach you to do the same.
But an ancient path could be seen as something that humans have been going through. Or
a universal truth.
Well, and the important thing is that it's timeless. It's just as applicable, which comes up all over. It's timeless. It's just as applicable now because it addresses the same problems now as it did 2,600 years ago.
Yeah, so. There's a little distinction for another night. Yeah. Thank you all. Sorry, I have to...
I'll talk to you later. And just one more thing about understanding that any human birth is prone to suffering. When we really understand that, when we understand it through right view, it leads to great compassion because we understand that everybody here has the common problem of dukkha. No matter how great your outer life might look, you're subject to dukkha. You're subject to sickness, aging, death. You're subject to not getting what you want. You're subject to getting what you don't want. You're subject of being something called the five clinging aggregates, being stuck in these views. Every single human being, we can't escape it. It's one of the reasons that can help diminish when we become very upset over other people and maybe other people in certain positions. We understand that even they are suffering. They're suffering greatly. And we can have realistic compassion for every human being. That's important today. Mm-hmm. It's at least as important as it was 2,600 years ago. And maybe I only say this because I'm living now. I think maybe it's even more important to understand that.
There's a lot more people now for problems to arise.
Yeah. There's. It just seems like there's a lot more immediate dukkha now than there ever was. But remember, the Buddha didn't live in utopia. There was just as much struggle, just as much violence, just as much competition, just as much wrong views then as there is now. So dukkha is the same. Ram, good to see you tonight.
I think I've said pretty much everything I wanted to say.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
But yeah, the view of seeing other people going through their own dukkha is, I believe, very important. And the more you get upset about somebody, the more important it is to look at that part. Like, really, do you think that anybody would be acting this way if they weren't in some kind of suffering?
Yeah.
Or maybe, but, you know, the worse their behavior is, the worse is their suffering, which leads to that kind of behavior.
Yeah, and that understanding takes the hate away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you think about all the terrible, vicious people we've had in the world. It doesn't excuse their behavior in any way, but we understand it. And what it does is it takes away my reaction, my hate, you know, what's going to cause suffering for me, because I understand where it's coming from. Again, we get approval and acceptance so mixed up together that in order for me to accept what's occurring, I also have to, it means that I approve it. I don't approve it, but it's what occurs. And it occurs because of ignorance. So if I really want to do something about it, here I go, watch out, here I go again. If I really want to do something about all the awful things in the world, about all the dukkha in the world, I'll end my own ignorance, because that's the only possible way that I can help others. That's the essence. That's when the Buddha is saying, when I was an unawakened bodhisattva, he's talking about a highly developed sense of compassion that he had prior to his awakening. But yet he wasn't very effective in changing the world around him, was he, until after he awakened. That's when he had the most impact. And I think continuing to this day. So. Frank, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to be here. Good to see everybody. I don't really have much to add to it. I need to keep things simple for myself. And the fact that there is an Eightfold Path, and that lately I've been really able to see with right view where I'm in wrong intention, and I can see where my own desires and passions lead me to kind of inner conflict a little bit. Knowing that the source of all suffering is the human mind, and when I take my mind out of it, and I can understand that the origination of suffering comes from my own personal ignorance of the framework that we're studying, things become so much easier.
Yeah.
And I can let everything go. So just staying in that mind frame, that process of meditating, being mindful of my own thoughts and feelings, my own involvement, like just going back and touching on the question about when does a child start to suffer. I mean, looking at my own path, I don't have any memory before 4 or 5 years old, and it was then when my suffering started, when the conscious mind and my own experience with the outside world, and thinking that all source of happiness was outside of myself, chasing thrills and excitements, getting that confused with what real happiness was, it doesn't change, it doesn't make me like it any better, but knowing and being able to see that view, makes me happy.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like the acceptance of it and knowing what goes on with my own human mind makes me feel relief that there's not something wrong with me.
Yeah.
You know, that it's just a human experience. That there's consequences, whether there's good consequences or bad consequences. And my unskillful behavior my whole life has led to bad consequences. And it just helps me keep on the path. Anyway, that's all I got.
Thank you. That was beautifully said. It is. The Eightfold Path is a simple path. We don't have to make it too complicated. You touched on, you reminded me of something. I my memory in this life goes back around to 4 or 5. And I grew up in a, you know, middle class, upper middle class, Berkeley Heights. Had everything that anybody really wanted or needed, and most of the things that I wanted. And I was miserable. You know, it was just a miserable little, I won't use the word. But it was because, I remember my future wife, just before we got married, she asked my mother, so what was John like as a child? My mother got this faraway look. John was a difficult child. And I was. Because even though I had all the things that any kid should ever want, it seemed like there had to be more to life. But I kept thinking it was outside things. And all the outside things that I got, all the presents and the toys and the things that were given to me, it was never enough. Nothing satisfied me. And that, I remember, it wasn't a clear thought, but thinking and feeling that how can I ever satisfy myself? And this is like 15, 16. What is there going to be in my life that's going to give me satisfaction? Nothing. Nothing can in that way, you know, if it's always, what do I need, what do I want? But yeah. I'm so fortunate that I came across an understanding of why I felt that way.
I was also thinking, you know, it was about the time when I started to have experiences with religion. My parents were taking me to church, and my first exposure to the external God that I didn't really experience that my entire life. If I had a method like this to practice and have a parent or somebody who was close to me that could explain it from an early age, not that I'm trying to change my past. I've given up all hope of changing my past.
And, good.
You know, I'm just like having a reflection on that, like how things could have been different having this kind of a knowledge base method and a framework. Something that I could actually experience and not like the belief system.
You know, it speaks right back to Andrew's question, you know, what do you do? Well, I think, and again, I'm not putting down any other beliefs or something. I was brought up Roman Catholic. What do? Bring up a child within the framework of the Eightfold Path, and, you know, at least you're giving them a chance.
Well, you know, this process for me, sorry if I'm taking a moment.
No.
This process for me, I've never been able to hear, like, what people say, like, God speaks to them or, like, things like that nature, like discernment. Instead of discursive thinking now, I can actually sit in silence after I'm done meditating where I don't have that overactive mind frame going. Let go of all my attachments, and I can feel a connection to something, like the power that's like way greater than me, part of just being alive, I guess, you know, and not having all that noise in my head.
Yeah, you don't have to necessarily name it God, it's just that there's
a power. Yeah. Definitely a power.
Yeah, the Buddha called that power Kalapas, but I won't get into that. He never said that there's no such thing as supreme beings. He simply recognized that the belief in that is not helpful in developing lasting peace and happiness right now. The problem, a supreme being is not cannot alter ignorance. If it could, it would have done so already.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any point in trying to describe what that power is.
It doesn't matter.
It's going to be the same for everybody, but a different experience.
Those are the questions that are not, the Buddha would say, and I get into it in the new book a little bit more. Those are questions that are simply unfit questions, meaning that they're not, the implication isn't unfit, it's just a distraction from developing a path. And so the Buddha would either respond by remaining quiet, not saying anything, which is a sign that the question doesn't deserve an answer, or he would say, the question or your comment is what's confusing you, let go of the question. You know, so important. Thank you. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good
How are
to
you?
See you? Good to see everyone. I cannot possibly follow that. I think that was really terrific, and I'm glad that you said what you said tonight. It was very articulate and very.
I agree.
Very helpful.
Glad you're here. Bonnie, good to see you.
That's it.
Sometimes
it's all
I have nothing to say, and then they like say. See, I have a watch set now.
That's impermanence. That's all that is. Experience of impermanence.
For me this week, it's been a lot of dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think, particularly on Monday, I had a situation where I think when I can, I've been calling it extreme empathy, when I can operate from that place, it keeps me from getting caught up in someone else's dukkha.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who said about, maybe it was you, about, you know, really seeing somebody sort of acting out, but really seeing it as like how unhappy they are and their distress in it. And so, by just staying in like extreme empathy, not taking not trying to change it or fix it, but just being clear about that, it's been really helpful. But I have attachments to things, to people, and just in general too, that we were talking about at dinner, that you know, it comes down to making a choice about how to. Maybe even to choose which dukkha.
the lesser of two dukkhas.
Yeah.
But that's the beginning of wisdom. You're describing developing right view. How else would you see? You wouldn't even be aware if you didn't have that. And that empathy is what we talked about. It's from understanding your own suffering so you can understand others. You know when people are acting crazy, you know where it's coming from. You don't have to take it personally. And you can have real empathy. And if somebody's throwing a rock at you, you get out of the way too. You know? It doesn't make you...
Porcupine
pose. Yeah. You know, I remember on the first retreat, somebody was getting a little frustrated going through this not-self thing. And they said... What about this no self, not self? What does it mean? What if you're on a train tracks and a train's coming at you? Take two steps to the right. It doesn't mean you become a fool. In fact, you become very wise. Two steps to the right. Get out of the way.
The other night on my way home, I listened. I have to ride home pretty late at night on Mondays, and there's a program called On Being on NPR.
Just the tippet.
Yeah, and I can't remember who was talking. Oh, I do. It was somebody who writes an article now on mindfulness for the New York Times. He says he doesn't write it, he curates it. So he brings people in. But one of the things, people were calling up and saying, you know, mindfulness is this, mindfulness is that. But the one thing the guy described about that it doesn't mean that we're not going to feel anything or not experience anger or sadness, but that the mindfulness and the meditation and following the path helps to be able to be very much in it and present with all of it. And
yeah.
I felt like I really appreciated that.
Yeah, that's a good description. The mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path doesn't mean you stop feeling. It means you have appropriate feelings and you don't need for them to be any different. We're human beings. Yeah. Human beings have feelings of fear and anger and all the right area, you know,
that's
joy and elation, but they're appropriate when we develop them, and we don't need them to be any different, and we don't react out of them. Even if a feeling of anger arises, there's stories in the Pali Canon where it's obvious that the Buddha is angry, but he's not acting out of anger. And most of that is frustration with people that have altered his path and tried to make it something that it's not. And you could, you know, he'd use phrases like, you foolish man, you're what you're doing is going to harm yourself and others for a long time. And he's obviously angry and frustrated.
The concept of like really allowing it to not have to be different is something that I have to really remind myself.
Yeah, this is just what we're, and if it's appropriate, there's no reason for it to be any different. And at that point, we wouldn't want it to be any different. You know, we feel whatever we feel when it's appropriate. Another way, because it's almost always written, the Eightfold Path, I'm talking about right view, right intention, etc., etc., it's almost more accurate to say appropriate view, appropriate intention.
Yeah. I think that appropriate or skillful sounds less judgmental.
Yeah.
It's just a translation thing.
Yeah, but if I taught it that way, I'd always have to be explaining why I'm using those words rather than. But yeah, it really is appropriate speech, appropriate action, appropriate mindfulness, appropriate meditation, appropriate effort. It's all part of it. You know? Appropriate. It's appropriate for what we're doing. Right. So now it's appropriate for the Karaniya Metta Sutta.
The skillful behavior. I really appreciate that.
So are there any other questions before we close? Okay. The only announcement I have is our retreat's coming up. If you haven't signed up and you want to go, sign up. The sooner the better. If you have... nobody's around.
As far as roommates go, are they just chosen?
Do you have a double? Or you want to... whoever you want to be with, just let me know and I'll hook you up. Anybody that's going or anybody online that's listening to this, if you want a special room assignment, just let me know and we'll do that. So, all right, so find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.